Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Mad Jin. With guest co-host...
Canis Albinus.
Oh, now I see what Dan said in the chat. I really need to invent that device to slap you on the internet.
Why are you upset with facts, Maggie?
Dan needs some.
I need some more facts, or I need some more estrogen.
Sure.
More work than one, apparently.
Hello, and welcome to episode 188. I'm your guest co-host, Canis Albinus, and I'm joined here with regular co-hosts, Dan Q.
Season's greetings.
Makalua.
Oh god, the Christmas music has started.
The Mian Team.
Hello over there.
And Mad Jin.
We're not here right now. Please call back later.
Phil means hello from down the well.
Your call is very important to us and will be answered in priority sequence.
That would be hilarious. It's like eat and call us at the same time. I don't know what else to do about that.
Please keep your hands, feet, arms, and head inside the stream at all times.
I disagree with that. I think there should be allowed some freedom in this regard.
Please don't jump into the stream.
Don't cross the streams.
Stick to the streams and...
It's rivers and lakes that you used to do, and I see where you're going with that.
Yeah. Well, see, I was trying to come up with a substitution for rivers and streams within context, but it kind of didn't work out, so... Oh, well.
Yeah, huh?
Channels?
Sorry to be so negative.
Bumper, are you trying to make a segue, Dan?
Yes, I am. I just did, Maggie.
You need a couple wheels.
On Reddit, somebody had the question about how much does the negative gulp return affect the AI? Do they cheat and get a free ride, or they just get penalized as well? It was Thief. Thief, you need to respell your name. Your I and E are reversed. Thief519. All right, it says the AI is notorious for cheating and getting benefits the player does and cannot receive, but how far does that go? He says he recalls someone telling him that the AI doesn't have their units destroyed when their gold reserves are depleted and their gold return is in the negatives, but does it affect their science? He pillages all the tiles, they still somehow receive money from some ghostly ally, or they stay at zero? You know, in short, what does all this pillaging do? Is it actually going to hurt them, or are they still going to be able to punk the units around and stuff?
As is already put out there by Putmalk, they don't cheat. In that respect, they have bonuses to prevent them from getting there in the first place, but they don't actually cheat once they get there. Yeah. And you have to keep in mind, because Game Man Dude mentions it, where he's like, oh, he got into war, and it's like, the AI's at negative 200 plus gold per turn, and it seems that there's no slowing of the flow of units coming from him. Keeping in mind that once you go negative gold per turn, and that soaks up all of your money, because that's where it comes from first. So if they still had a lot of just gold sitting around, then negative gold per turn doesn't matter. But even if they do run out of that, it's going to come out as science next. And if you're a little bit later in the game and you have plenty of science coming out, well, you can afford mass negative gold per turn. You're just not going to research it much of anything at all. To really get your units completely disbanded and other stuff like that, you really have to go like massive negative gold per turn once you get your science up before anything like that actually happens.
Whoa, somebody was playing Game of France and Napoleon had negative 2,800 gold per turn.
How do you even manage that?
I don't know. That guy also himself had plus in the first 916 a turn, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays you can do it fairly easily with all those trade routes and everything else. And if you focus on gold, if you're that focused on gold, you're kind of lacking in other areas.
It just seems like if you were getting negative, like, 3,000 a turn, that it wouldn't last very long before you start getting it disbanded, unless your science is just incredible about it.
Well, it's really hard also to get to that negative. You can't do trade deals for more than your gold per turn that you already have.
You'd have to have all your cities sit there and spam out a bazillion units.
Yeah, and not work gold. And.
Yeah. So that negative 2,800 was pretty special.
Yeah.
I wonder what the record is.
I think we just saw it.
Maybe.
I've seen threads with them in the negative 5,000s, but I think that was a bug of some kind.
Mm.
And yeah, there is sometimes bugs where what gets displayed to you is not necessarily the same as what it actually is, depending on which screen you're looking at. So if you just look at the Diplo screen, those numbers can be completely different than what's actual. You actually have to go into the trade.
Come on, we didn't have to port that from Civ 4.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You go look at the Diplo screen, it's like, oh, you're massively negative. And then you go into the Diplo screen, it's like, oh, you're massively positive. Oh well. There's just some weird stuff in there.
Yeah.
You can break AIs if you do it well enough, but...
So it was helping the game when I and Dan were on the same continent the other night and I pillaged the crap out of Ethiopia.
Yeah, that helps.
Gives you money, slows down the AI's production.
Of course, on that front, you have to not just pillage, but you have to stand on all their tiles. Otherwise, they can actually work them still. Just, you know, pillaged, but they can still work them.
Yeah.
I mean, the only way to really starve them down is to just flood every single tile in their neighborhood with units. That way they can't work anything, and all they have left is the city.
That sounds expensive.
It is. And more than a little unnecessary, because frankly, if you can fill every single tile, you probably could have just took the city, or you're playing on Settler. One of the two.
Well, then you definitely could have taken the city.
Probably. To answer the question, no, there's no code specifically that says AI can cheat versus a player with respect to disbanding units and other stuff like that. It's just really hard to force an AI into that situation.
There are situations where the AI rules and the human rules are not identical, but this is not one of them.
True. Speaking about AI rules versus human rules, huh? That's a segue. Although, is it a segue if you point out that it's a segue?
Maybe we can rule that's a quasi-segue.
We always point out segues, so it better count.
Well, we're just going to roll on by. Should city-states be bigger is the question from the Practical Aviation Cat. So we have flying kitties, but practically. He wants to know, should city-states be bigger? And not just, you know, bigger. The way he's talking about it, he's suggesting that they don't get very big. They get around 15 pop and only expand to like 7 tiles. When humans go OCC, they get a massive mega city. Think city states should be the same. Opinions?
The way some maps work out, I don't think I want them bigger, because then where the hell do I get to settle?
Well, I guess bigger, he's more thinking in the concept of their one city should be higher population, they should have more units, they should have a higher, more space in their around their one city, because they don't have the culture buildings necessarily. And that's actually one thing, especially for Brave New World, is from what I can remember, city-states don't build the guilds. And therefore, that's a lot of culture that would normally fuel the city tile grabbing. As for population, I have seen city-states bigger than 15 pop, so I guess it depends on your difficulty level, about how big they actually get. They can get bigger, but basically they're not meant to be an OCC thing. And as is pointed out by a variety of people, if the city-states manage to get much higher population, patronage becomes even more powerful, et cetera, because of the science leech out of the city-states that you're allied with. So if you hyperpump all the minor powers, you've basically turned them into massive science generators.
So their current kind of smaller size might actually be a balance on not making patronage super powerful, because Alexander's a pain in the ass enough now.
Yeah, that too.
It would make the game more challenging that way, until you broke it by taking advantage of all the city-states yourself, of course.
True.
Well, in my experience, the city-states don't usually spawn in places where high food is really possible.
Yeah, there is that also other issue.
At least not until the late game.
Yes, there's definitely that issue too. They tend to get placed after all the major civs. So yeah, they don't necessarily always get the best locations for growth. I mean, they usually get some resources and sometimes get rivers, but I've seen, city-states with really, really crappy land that no human would be able to actually work properly. And then, of course, with respect to military units and all that, people in the Reddit thread were talking about, you know, some city-states need more military units. They have to build more. But yeah, no.
I don't know. By the medieval era, they seem to have a pretty good carpet going.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the city-states. And as was discussed, it sort of depends on whether or not they're personality is there for hostile, friendly, et cetera, let alone if they're militaristic versus others, or if they can even afford it. Because keep in mind, if they're put into a situation where they don't have a gold per turn income, or at least not a good one, then it's going to be hard for them to actually field units.
For a time, city-states also tend to have a higher defense, like city strength value as well, as compared to major civilization cities, air quotes.
Air quotes. Well, usually, I mean, they all count as capitals, so they all get the capital bonus. And any city-state that starts on a hill also gets the hill plus capital bonus. And they're more likely to build walls and stuff like that than major civs, because, well, they only have one city. Not to mention, city-states always get given technology. So once at least two civs have a technology, the city-states get it right off the mark. So they don't have to worry about actually researching anything. They just get given all the techs, which means, you know, if multiple civs have the defensive techs, city-states are all going to get it right away. There is things that can be done to make city-states stronger, or at least more useful, like allowing city-state allies into your own territory during a war. Rather than having the city-states just sit there and go, I'd love to help you with that little war over there, but your borders are in the way, so I can't get there. That is a bit of an issue.
It would make sense if you ally yourself with the city-state, then that also counts as open borders for city-state units.
Yep.
Yeah, a little advanced diplomacy there would be nice.
Yeah, like, we're allied. Why don't you come in and help me? No.
That would be great until the AI starts putting things on tiles you want to improve.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in theory, it's during a war, so if they go towards defending against aggression, then they would at least be on the front lines and in the right area.
Yeah, that would be good.
And as for city-states only expanding to 7 tiles, as the opening poster suggested, I mean, Mackie already talked about, you know, taking up even more and more land, but if we define like a city-state, like it's a central city and its surrounding villages, surrounding terrain, we already have that. So in addition to there being gameplay reasons, there's also realism being reflected here. And it's actually on the same page. That's a rare thing.
Yeah. They're meant to be small. Because if every city-state took up all the hexes within 5 of their city by the time the game was over, yeah, you'd have a hard time finding land.
And if you want city-states to be bigger, then if you ally them and they're in a war with you, let them take some cities.
Yeah.
Then they are bigger. Ho, ho, ho.
They will. They'll get bigger. So, over on Reddit, again, am I not allowed reading stuff from the forums anymore? Is that it? Dan just banned me from reading stuff on the forums.
Well, I didn't want to say anything, but...
You are now our official Reddit man. Enjoy being Reddit man.
Opposed asks, is new to Civ and is wondering if you could change what city is your capital city. The answer is no, but thanks for coming out.
The quote-unquote only way for that to happen, short of playing, for instance, playing Civilization 4, as an example.
Yeah, there you go. Play a different game.
Would be to allow your capital to be captured, and we would highly advise against this.
Yeah, basically, in Civ 5, no, you can't directly move your capital like you could in Civ 4 or 3. You can't just build a palace somewhere else and be happy with it. And even if you lose your original capital and you get a brand new capital, it's still your original capital that counts for absolutely everything. So
this would ruin the domination victory horribly, because people would just teleport their capital around and you wouldn't be able to capture it.
Yeah, it's like, hey, look, I found a spot over here in the ice that you can't reach by boat or by people. All right, that's my new capital.
Yeah, we just airlift everything out, right?
Air, fire, fire.
It's whack-a-mole for the 21st century.
Yeah.
Whack a capital. Nope, it's here. Nope, it's here. Nope, jump, jump.
You build a new city, you move your capital over there. Now it gets all the tradition growth bonuses and a bunch of other stuff and all the culture boost for the lower cost to expand your borders around that city, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, basically, there's a lot of game mechanics based around the capital that would be a little bad. Like maritime city-states now giving +2 food to your capital in your new capital.
There was a piece of this in Civ 4, by the way, and it's probably why they made it the way they did with the domination victory in Civ 5. Basically, a precursor to this was avoiding their capital capture and space race In Civ 4, after you launched the spaceship, if somebody captured your capital in the time it took to reach Alpha Centauri, your spaceship would be destroyed and you'd have to start over. But yep. Since you could build the palace cheaply, you really could just move that around in one turn in any high production city, or maybe one or two turns, and keep your capital alive that way, and then receive no penalty for having your original capital captured. That was a bit problematic.
And another reason for this, like Dimple suggests, I think you should be able to build a palace to change capital cities. You shouldn't be able to purchase the building, you'd have to build it. Well, there's this thing where you could build it and then have like one turn left on it and then go away from it. And I know there's a production decay, but still, it's not instantaneous. So, yeah, even that's not going to work.
Yeah, pre-build palace in 5 different cities and then pick the one that you need to run away from.
I could hear somebody say, oh, I'm going to use your words against you, Polycast. You talked about opportunity cost. Well, what if you spend all those turns building those capitals minus, you know, one turn in a particular city, then you've wasted all those turns for something you could have built. Well, we're assuming that you would only do this if you thought there was a reasonable chance that, you know, your capital was in peril.
Yeah.
And that's very situational, that you would either think not only are you going to lose the capital, but the capital is going to be lost and you're not going to be able to get it back. They can't even raise it, so think that you're going to be able to lose it and not keep it. Well, since you know they can't raise it, then just go get it back.
Yep. Or while they're attacking it, you can move your capital and burn the city down and give them nothing.
Why don't you just use all those hammers pre-building the palace and make units with them to protect your original capital?
No. We can't. It's just silly.
This is more trolley.
Again, it does depend how much you make the palace, but I don't see any reason to put this into the game, especially with how it would also break social policies a bit.
Yeah. In the end, I think part of the reason it was in Civ 4 was because of the further away from your capital, yada, 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 mechanics.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you could always move your capital to the center of your empire or somewhere else where you need it. So
yeah, or maybe about a third of the way in, because then you'd build Forbidden Palace at the other end. It was seldom worth it. Often even courthouses weren't. So that's a topic for another time.
And we discussed in the past, you know, how many times have you moved your capital in Civ 4? On purpose.
I remember when you guys asked that question. The answer was once, when I was learning what it did when you built it.
Over and over again. Palaces are awesome. Let's build them everywhere.
No maintenance. Eat commerce. I gotta get this.
Wait, what happened to my capital?
What are your secrets on growth? And yes, still talking about Civilization 5. It's not a question about you personally in real life. Well, I like to set goals and reflect. No, that's not the kind of growth we're talking about here. Although I suppose you can reflect on your gameplay. Daily Nightshade says, my biggest issue is growth. And he says it in all caps, so I have to yell it. Again and again, I find myself lacking behind in science because I fail to keep up with the AI and their insane growth. I thought I had covered all bases, but apparently I haven't. These are the measures I take. Micromanaging of the city screens, prioritizing production when building settlers, wonders, and other important stuff, focusing on food when I don't, going with religious plus growth bonuses, improving tiles rather early, mostly aiming for a tall empire with 3 to 4 cities and a tradition opener and finisher, building food wonders, such as the Hanging Gardens, and food boosting my cities with internal trade routes. So yeah, what else is it that I can do? Well, there are a number of things that you can do, and most of them were actually raised in this thread. And there were some people repeating the same points, which is a general indication that it is probably a good idea. For me, yeah, it's been a while, so I did kind of turn this into a top 10, only it's not so much ranked in order of importance as it is more or less either chronology or just...
Oh, random side point. He's talking about Venice.
Yeah, I know it's within the context of Venice, but quite frankly,
it's semi-important.
I extrapolated this more generally. Your secrets on growth in general, to which this can also benefit Venice to certain degrees. And obviously there's some variation in there because no settlers for poor Venice. Aww.
You should probably work food tile.
No.
Probably.
Yeah, being obvious here.
Yeah. It's all about earlier the better, basically. The sooner you get to everything, the better it will be. Because growth is one of those situations where, yeah, you can, you know, build up by turn 100 a very nice huge food per turn going into your city, but if you're still at like 5 or 6 pop, then you've wasted a lot of time. Because growth really slows down over time, just because of the way things get. Obviously, aqueducts as fast as possible, so going tradition's a nice way to do that. But again, earlier is better. As Venice, though, that optics-free Merchant of Venice and getting to currency for more Merchants of Venice to be able to grab closest possible city-states for sending internal food trade routes, very important. His list of things that he's doing is generally okay, but probably the one thing he's missing is that he's trying to keep up with the AI growth bonuses.
That's going to be hard no matter what.
Yeah. Considering you can see AIs hit like 50, 60 pop cities by the end of the game usually, that's a little harder to try and keep up on.
Yes, because you do not receive the derp bonus, as we referred to it before, and you are not going to receive the derp bonus.
Yeah.
Yeah, usually when I'm setting up build order, I try to intersperse grow things along with the science things and faith things and all sorts like that, starting out in my capital, even when you're not in Venice, mm-hmm. so that way you still keep growing. Because if you try to go all growth at first, then where's your science?
Yeah, I mean, AIs don't use academies often. I mean, they do plant some random stuff, but they aren't as focused. And that's kind of more the important thing, is staying focused. So you can have a smaller pop capital than the AI, but if you've got like half a dozen or more academies sitting around your capital, you're going to do more science than they are.
The first thing on my list is, I'm actually a bit of a hypocrite putting this on this list because I don't do this very often. I really should do this more. But I'm serving the spawn vicinity. Where, you know, there could actually be advantage to moving your settler, even if it means delaying settling your capital or two, if it means you can work more food tiles and more food tiles earlier. So, for example, your first or even your second ring of your borders outside of your capital has more food tiles as opposed to it being in your third. Second would be to prioritize water settling, either river, so you can then research the wheel and get the water mill, or go onto the coast, and that is for future moving of food to subsequent cities that are also on the coast, otherwise known as internal trade routes. From the city screen, set to food focus for as much as is practical during the game.
No. No. No.
Yes.
No.
No.
No. No.
Yes. Absolutely.
No. No.
Yes, I'm going to disagree with you then. No, you want to set to food focus. That's why I said for as much as is practical during the game.
No. You set yourself production focus, but manually select every single food tile. That way you grow, and then when your new population comes out, it will automatically jump into the production tile, give you food, and then on your turn, you can give you a production right away on that moment, and then you can move it to food. But if you're set yourself to food focus, you lose all possible food that you could gain from that new population, because food comes first in the order. It does food first, gets you your new pop, subtracts all the other food, and if it gives you your new pop, it'll put it on food if you're on food focus, but you don't get more food because it's already done the calculations for food. Anyways.
Yeah, we've overruled Dan loudly.
No. You set to food focus, and then you're able to actually work the production tiles. I'm respectfully disagreeing. We're going to move on. Research pottery. So yeah, okay, you can build your shrine, but there is this thing called a granary for +2 food, and then you got wheat, bananas, deer, +1 food. Also allows the moving of food, regards to this internal trade route thing. And then if you research animal husbandry, there's your first trade route, land enabling, and then sailing for coast enabling. So use internal trade routes to send food from your capital to as many of your subsequent cities as possible. And as we've talked about before on the show, preferably cargo ships to caravans because of the considerable increased capacity. Obviously not just on food, but since we're talking about food, we'll focus here on food. If you're prioritizing water settling, then hopefully you have some coastal cities, so you want to get yourself some lighthouses so you can get +1 food from coast and ocean tiles. And if there are any fishes, fish!
Fish!
You also get +1 food. Imagine mentioned already the tradition social policy. So you got a greater increase of border expansion, thereby getting to more food tiles more quickly without having to purchase, although there is also that. And there's two reasons beyond that. There's subsequent policies. Choosing legalism, this is kind of an indirect thing. Okay, yes, free monument in your first 4 cities, so you get even more border growth and no maintenance with them. And then you can get yourself to a landed elite, which is +10% growth and +2 food in the capital. And then you could also consider monarchy as well, although it's diminishing returns on that point, particularly when you're having to choose, okay, am I going to adopt something else in tradition or am I going to go to another social policy instead? But if you choose monarchy, then you reduce the unhappiness from your increased population size. And you'll also be able to build the Hanging Gardens as of Brave New World, because this wonder requires the adoption of tradition, and that's plus 6 food.
Our cargo ship gives you better than the Hanging Gardens. If you want to balance out where you're putting the hammers, internal trade route for the cargo ship is better than the Hanging Gardens.
Yeah, you have to remember that that's magic food that comes from nowhere. It's not deducted from this other city.
Mm-hmm. Plus the AI likes building the Hanging Gardens anyways, so you don't have to fight for it.
If you research engineering, this is the aqueduct that Manjin mentioned, that's 40% of food is carried over after a new citizen is born, thereby decreasing the amount of food a city needs to increase in size by 40%. If you research civil service, then farms next to rivers and lakes produce 1 food each. And as was also mentioned in this thread, and just as a general point, stay at happy for as much as possible throughout the duration of the game, otherwise you do get a growth hit.
Yeah, like -99%.
Honorable mentions would be, yeah, buy then work those tiles if they produce more food than a tile your city is currently working for food. Be situational. Suggested in the thread about constructing the Temple of Artemis for plus 10% growth in all cities. I wouldn't put that as like a top 10, but okay. Just like it was also suggested to become friends, if not allies, of maritime city-states. A little more, what's the word I'm looking for, desirable in vanilla than with Gods and Brave New World, but still pretty decent.
Early game is the only thing that matters, and if you can do, when it comes to growth anyways, do a few quests for the maritime city-states to get at least friend level, that's equivalent to the granary that you can build food for your capital. And the more of them though you get, the faster you grow, and the faster you grow, the faster you can produce, the faster you produce, the faster you get everything else, and the game's already over by turn 100 if you do it really well, at least efficiently.
Yeah, that's also a lot of ifs,
yeah.
Which is, no, don't get me wrong, it's still valuable, but particularly post-Brave New World with internal trade routes, it's not as desirable as it was in Vanilla or Gods and Kings, but it's still there, so it's absolutely worth mentioning.
Oh, yeah.
Someone suggested about adopting food boosting advantages from, you know, like a pantheon through shrines and religion. It's kind of one of those, it's not that that's bad, it's just that there are probably some other pantheons or even beliefs that are more desirable overall, especially if you're doing all these other things for food, then you can get something to complement. But, I mean, if you get Temple of Artemis and or Hanging Gardens, okay, if you adopt fertility rites for increased growth by 10%, and if you get religion and you get plus 50% faster growth rate for city if you're not at war with the swords into plowshares, those stack rather nicely.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, people keep talking about the Temple of Artemis like it's this big thing, but frankly, that's a lot of hammers that you're not using for, I don't know, that cargo ship for the internal trade route or that settler for being able to send stuff over to it. As much as it does provide a nice bonus, I've just never really believed in going straight for a wonder that early in the game where you basically convert that wonder into the loss of all sorts of other stuff when it comes to actually building it. Because you're also building it when you're a super low population. So if you're trying to actually get it, then you're not trying to grow. So that also causes other problems. I mean, it's nice to steal from somebody, like let the AI build it and then go take it. That's useful.
I mean, yeah, archery, you're going to get it relatively quickly in terms of a technology, and you don't need to adopt tradition in order to construct it like you do with the Hanging Gardens. If you have a really heavy production capital and you can work that relatively quickly, then maybe it's worth it. But that's why I put it as an honorable mention. It's not a secret. It's kind of a, well, now and again thing that it can be nice. And then lastly, I think this also generally applies just like the happiness. When we're talking about growth, and Deadly Nightshade talks about having aiming for like a tall empire, 3 to 4 cities. Okay, so you've got your capital, and yes, of course, you want it to grow. If you're looking about subsequent city settling, the sooner you know about your surroundings, you're going to be able to place your subsequent cities better in terms of being able to get the growth, to then be able to work the production, to then be able to do whatever it is that you want to do. There's nothing like just exploring a little and, oh, I'll settle here, here's some food. And then you realize, if only I'd explored a little more, then I could have actually gotten that tile, and that one city would have been better than trying to do 2 cities now, and just save yourself the heartache. I mean, you should be exploring anyway.
Oops, I put myself on a coast because it was awesome, and then I found out it's ice blocked. Yes, scouting does matter, because yeah, if you're going for the super tall, you definitely need to know what is around before you place the next city. because every city that you place must be able to grow and must be able to do something useful.
Now, ideological tenets did not come up in this thread, and I understand that, particularly given they're going to emerge later game. I already hear people who do advanced start say, wait a minute, it's more relevant than you think. Yes, okay, fine then. But if you look at whether it's order, freedom, or autocracy, and I'm just thinking about growth specifically, and again, this always comes with the qualification of you choose one tenet just like you choose a social policy. It comes at the exclusion or at least the delaying, since we don't have any, oh, you adopted this policy, you can't adopt this policy nonsense anymore. There are two or three in both order, freedom, and autocracy that you can choose. And yes, there's this like universal healthcare. Ooh, because we talk about, oh, happiness is important. So plus two local happiness from every national wonder. That particular one is usually, to me, like an alternative choice. Although with autocracy, I would choose that as my second level one so that I can get to the plus two local happiness from every barracks, armory, and military academy. Combine that with fortified borders where you've got the plus two local happiness from every walls, castle, arsenal, or military base. Freedom has specialists consuming only half the normal amount of food, and then either capitalism for the plus one local happiness from your mint banking stocks exchanges, or again, universal suffrage. And then if you get the level two freedom of universal suffrage, where specialists and cities produce half the normal unhappiness, and golden ages are 50% longer, that's a good choice. If you're like, I want to keep going on freedom, I want to get another level two tenant so I can grow even more, okay, I guess you could look at urbanization for plus one local happiness from granary, watermill, aqueduct, and hospital. And if it's order, and I love the order ideology, as everyone knows, socialist realism, plus two local happiness from monuments. And then if you get local pioneers from plus one local happiness from every workshop, factory, and or solar, nuclear, and hydro plant, then you can get yourself the party leadership, which is plus one food, production, science, gold, and culture per city. And as much as I love order, I do acknowledge that when it comes to happiness in general and then translating into growth, I will give the nod to autocracy being better off than the other two most of the time. As much as it pains me to admit it, I will admit
except
it.
If you're going super tall freedom and the reduced unhappiness from specialists and other such some does count fairly heavily towards your unhappiness issues for growth.
Yeah, really, actually, order is, for specifically on this front, is arguably overall the weakest, but it's not weak. Mm. There's a difference.
Yeah, I guess the difference is if you are trying to say the small empire, freedom, and the unhappiness-related ones there is a little better than autocracy, but if you're going wider, then autocracy is going to be better, just for the sheer volume. And one thing that tends to get blatantly ignored is fertilizer. I don't think anybody said anything about fertilizer in this thread. If you don't have the granary related stuff, like if you don't have a giant river, but you have a bunch of sheep or cow or other food boosters, getting over to fertilizer earlier rather than later does tend to give you that pretty hefty growth boost in the mid game. It's just, it's not on the path to industrialization or, you know, whatever other paths people want to get to be able to get the early ideology, let alone more science. But if you happen to be going for cannons, then pit stop at fertilizer will give you a pretty hefty food boost, especially if you have a city that does not have a river, but does have a lot of grassland around it.
And you're right. We had not yet talked about fertilizer. And I suppose another secret for growth would be to play on a difficulty level that's lower than what you would normally play on. Am I trolling now? I think so.
There's lots of different ways to grow, but mostly location, location, location. Plant yourself in a position where you can grow really fast early in the game.
Pair location, location, location with happy, happy, happy.
Mm-hmm. Stay happy, otherwise you don't grow.
And of course, nobody mentions medical labs because they're useless.
I was waiting for somebody.
More like they come so late that they don't make that huge of a difference.
If you beeline it, you can get to them early enough that they will probably make a difference in the last like 10 or 15 pop. But, eh.
And definitely not a in all of your cities.
Yeah, only the ones you want to grow more.
Unless you got a really small empire. Let's try to look at this as a glass half full as opposed to a glass half empty. So rather than saying, don't construct medical labs because they're useless, we can say, don't construct medical labs and save your hammers.
Mm-hmm. Or get there early enough for it to matter.
We have a thread here from Captain Patch on Civ Fanatics. who brings up the question, should we give experience and promotions to workers? He says, unlike the other small or civilian units like great people, missionaries, inquisitors, etc., workers persist after their first use. They stay around the entire game, and they have specialization just like military units, but they don't get promotions like military units do. So he believes they should add a set of worker promotions to reflect their developing expertise. He suggests 3 promotions in a row, removing 1 turn for project duration on each one. Another set of 3 promotions, adding movement points for the first one for everywhere, the second for traveling on roads, and the third for when fleeing nearby enemy units. And the final one he suggests is stealth, so they don't get spotted by enemy units.
Hmm. Don't mind me building this giant fortress. Dun-de-dum-de-dum.
You know,
stealth fortress.
There's something to be said about comparing this to military units, though, because with military units, the rate at which you get promotions varies a lot based on what you're actually doing in the game. Whereas with workers, you're probably using them to make improvements as much as you can. And if you're microing well, there's not going to be a lot of variance there. So basically, that would just wind up being a global buff to workers. I don't know that we need that per se. So unless there's some way to make this a bit more dynamic, I don't see it in this form.
Yeah, well, then there's the, well, what do we do with the pyramids, which gives worker buffs, liberty, which gives worker buffs, movement point when traveling on roads and railroads, well, there's tech buffs for that, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's kind of, there already is experience for workers indirectly through those things, as opposed to directly from it as the workers do. So I guess it becomes a question of where do you want the experience to be reflected? And quite frankly, I prefer it as it is right now, because this is a non-military unit, like is pointed out. So yes, these units do stick around, unlike, say, workboats or great people or missionaries or inquisitors. I suppose I could be convinced otherwise, but like the specifics in terms of the promotions they get, like minus 1 turn to project duration, wow. I know we can't stack workers, but still, I think that becomes a bit too much if you start doing the math over an extended period of time.
Well, I mean, there's a little issues like, oh, unit pillages a tile, you instant fix it, and it pillages the tile again.
Oh, that fun little thing. Combat workers. They're almost like combat medics.
I mean, they're not going to patch that out. I thought that was going to be patched out a while ago.
Well, it takes such a specific edge case for that to even work, like, sufficiently, that it's kind of, yeah. But if you give them experience and also give them these minus turns project duration, like minus 3 turns to project duration basically means you can build most basic tile improvements in 1 turn or instant. And if you have a unit that has no movement cost to pillaging, just pillage, 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 pillage. Don't mind me. I'm just going to master boost. Granted, I would suggest that he was probably thinking that we would remove, say, the Liberty side and the pyramid stuff and whatever tech-based things just to give them a benefit of the doubt so that it's not stacked on top of that. And in that respect, maybe.
By some incentive, some minimum, that build your workers earlier then.
Yeah, and, you know, choose an experience tree. I'm not sure reductions to project duration should be there. One promotion could be, instead of being captured, it auto-moves to the next tile, because, you know, workers can be grabbed right off the mark. It's a no-cost thing.
It seems like, by his logic, we should be giving every unit on the field that's military a promotion just because one of them gets a promotion.
Or because they exist.
Yeah.
Build military units early and upgrade them, and you should have, like, hardcore veterans by the modern era, even if they just sat in your capital.
And besides, when a worker completes a train improvement or repairs something, it's really giving benefit in other forms, from food and production and science and movement and trade and win.
Yeah.
Potentially. So the individual, it's a bit more abstracted. The experience by workers is reflected otherwise in the game in those more general things, as well as more specific things like wonders and social policy trees.
But, I mean, if you want to go that way, you could do promotions like 33% less project duration for working in a jungle or something like that for specialties. So you can think of it that way rather than just a direct project duration reduction or other stuff. But yeah, realistically, workers are not meant to be that useful.
They're not supposed to be Uber.
Yeah, they already do like everything to make your empire bigger without actually using military units. So making them even better and therefore getting a better empire out of it faster kind of throws balance off, causes other issues.
Six half dozen of the other, but the way workers right now, I don't see that it's broken. So if something isn't broken, it doesn't need to be fixed.
Full wrap about six. It's about, what, a little bit over 6 minutes long, and it's worth a listen because it's hilarious.
To me, it's less about the rap itself. I'm not a particular fan of rap. I like the words, and I also like the music as well, but it's more about the words. I kind of look at it more as like a poem.
I don't like the rap, but I like the words. The whole point of behind rap is the words.
I don't like how it's said. Like, just the rap form is, I find it a bit abrasive. But the message, like, if you actually look at the lyrics and just read the lyrics and forget about the visual. I mean, it comes from cutscenes from Civ. I know some people in the comments are more familiar with him and not with Civ. Someone's like, how did you get all this amazing animation? But lines, Time's quill is quick to spill its ink onto a new page, or the better the tech is, the lesser the effort to wreck it, the less time to see their eyes and feel sympathetic. It's about civilization, the game, but it's also about, like, lowercase c. It's about civilization, period. In that way, it's quite powerful. It's not like some songs that we've heard before where there's something more specific to the game that if you weren't familiar with the game, you'd be like, okay, why is that interesting? Why is that relevant? Whereas this has a more general appeal in terms of the words, and it was because of that that I listened to it.
The faces are the same as when in days gone, the brains are cultivated, thus creating the Renaissance. We're still using steel tools to stay strong, replacing blades with greater trades, pen and paper song. Faith in God is tested, hiding in the desert, men excited, then enlightened by the scientific method.
Even if you don't like rap, so if you don't like listening to it, and you can watch the lyrics on the screen, because it's not just a video and then him set speaking. He's actually put in the video what it is that he's saying. You don't have to rely on, like, YouTube captain ability, fortunately. In that way, it is very impressive. It is well done.
Speaking of hilarious, so the YouTube auto captions are generally hilarious.
Yep.
They are.
Not useful, but hilarious.
Allies and axes charging each other like batteries, a power vacuum allowing the super states to flourish. We distribute the food even if it means people are malnourished. Propaganda is the only view that you're allowed to publish, because totalitarians are well aware of how to punish. Gunning down numbers countless for doubtless nothings that they've done, but that won't stop subversive insurgents from coming out with courage.
And like some of the comments, even though I haven't even played this game, I still think this is one of your most powerful raps ever. This person has almost 200 videos and more than 400,000 subscribers. So if we can let more people know about the addiction that is Civ, then all the better. Ha, one of us. The last quote was from CPU Poner. Grapes for All says, this game is okay. Wasn't going to get it. Your rep made me change my mind, and now I'm excited to get my hands on it. Some Sort of Thing says, wow, I normally hate rap, but this is amazing. It's just a brief history of the world, epic in its true definition. And As For A Amateur's Page says, okay, that's it. Now I have to play Civilization again, already ahead of you.
We have an Advisor of the Week. Advisor of the Week is a simple tip for winning battles. And it's to keep an eye on enemy's line of vision. AI will not attack unless it can see its target the turn before. That's interesting, because it isn't true in Civ 4. And he goes on to explain the importance of this in naval battles. So, yeah, it's a helpful tip, I suppose.
Otherwise known as the game code sucks.
Yeah. I think you do have to find a happy balance there, though, because this was a really grating issue in Civ 4. if you positioned a unit anywhere within a naval unit's range, it could see you and attack you no matter what. Like, someone did an experiment where they literally catty-cornered workboats with an AI destroyer centered in the middle in Civ 4, and it was really bad. Like, if you move just one tile out of its range, its AI script would change, it would go somewhere else. But no matter where you put it, it would always hit you in the fog. Really annoying. And that had bad implications. They're like, the AI would suicide into your territory to get your worker with, like, a knight. It's so stupid.
Well, there has to be a form of balance in there where, frankly, yeah. AI units in Civ 5 that basically don't, even if they do find you, and that, I think that's the difference here, line of sight issues in Civ 4 where they could see everything on the map and then went for it, versus Civ 5, they don't get the extra sight line, and even if they do find you in the fog, they don't actually attack you unless they're melee units, because it's the ranged units that won't move then shoot. It is a standard problem. It is a hated problem. Must be killed. So this simple tip for winning battles is all about abusing the AI.
Well, that's how you win the game general code. Single player, is you abuse the AI. Let's be real, the bonus is that's exactly what you do to win.
Effectively, if they can move and shoot, then if they learn how to move and shoot with ranged units, they'd be okay.
The other thing to this topic is that you can provide your own insights and could be featured in a future post. So if you're interested in this aspect of Facebook, go for it.
Or just go to YouTube and find better stuff.
Perhaps.
Better stuff.
You live on Facebook and never leave Facebook. You always have Facebook open as long as you have an internet browser open. Then why not?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not thinking of anyone specific here.
It's an okay tip. I'm not really certain it's kind of one of those things that's not documented elsewhere, but okay. I think it's like an underwhelming tip for people like us who are already familiar with the game. It's definitely geared more towards people just getting into the game.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah, and that's fine.
You might be able to point out the most broken bugs in the game and create a tip around them, and then that'll get their attention. There you go. Here's a tip. Make the AI declare war on other AI and get no diplomatic penalty for it.
Woo! Or gift some nukes.
Well, yeah, but nukes come later in the game. You always get nukes. There's no excuse to not get nukes ever, because nukes are the best thing in all Civ games, no matter what. But before you have nukes, you still can create chaos.
Mm-hmm. There's a special tech for that.
Is it called diplomacy?
No, that's not a tech.
Yeah, this getting one AI to declare on another AI and not getting a diplomatic penalty. This is channel your inner child. Just spread rumors, really, about one person to another.
That's the thing
is, it's fun. They really need to put in some penalty for doing it because it's too strong.
Or at least there's a chance through some combination of existing mechanics that one AI or the other or both will find out what it is that you've been up to.
Yeah. You know, there's these things called spies and diplomats.
Yeah, tight espionage, exactly.
Oh, share intrigue, I got it.
Yeah, like, hey, did you know that guy paid that guy to attack you?
I would like it that way better than the AI just automatically knowing like it didn't sit far.
True.
Yes.
It's like, hey guys, guy over there is willing to pay everybody to attack him.
You are now our worst enemy. On meeting us.
There was a post by Olson on CFC back on the 21st of November saying, I think it's been nearly 2 years since Polycast said anything about Civ 4. This past summer, I listened through the archives a couple of times until I understood things. The more I learn about Civ 4, the more I realize a lot went unsaid. After the December 4th, 2011 airing, Polycast became irrelevant to Civ 4 players, which seems an unnecessary shame because even now, Civ 4 seems to have 30 to 50% of the combined CFC visitor totals of Civ 4 and Civ 5 whenever I'm logged on. It would have been nice if Polycast didn't abandon Civ 4 completely. It was like having a favorite TV show canceled too soon. I replied that I'm pleased to say that you are incorrect and hope that you will be pleased to be corrected. In our current season, we had a Civ 4 topic that's part of episode 177. If you go back to 2012, so our sixth season, or just our last season, one or more Civ 4 topics appeared in 15 episodes, as well as the Christmas special, covering more than half of all of its episodes. Search for Civilization 4, the phrase on the season's page on the Polycast website. You can find these with ease. And speaking on behalf of myself and my fellow regular co-hosts, if you believe there's a Civ 4 topic that we haven't discussed on Polycast but should, or a topic that you believe you feel should be revisited, we have done this before, by all means, we hope that you will let us know. We appreciate all feedback we receive from our audience, praise and constructive criticism alike, as it helps us to better engage with members of the audience, such as yourself.
There are a few things that we could cover that are new since we've last covered Civ 4. I'll hunt some topics for you so that we can cover it. General strategy of high-level play has evolved a little bit, so we can revisit a few things. I'll work with Dan on that.
There are also things that kind of go undocumented in a way. Like when we talk about some things for Civilization 5, comparison to Civ 4 is often inevitable. And that actually happened today. So although that's not a direct coverage of Civ 4, we are kind of harking back to it. It was actually a different take on the question of Civ 4 versus Civ 5, just because apparently Olson had thought we hadn't discussed Civ 4 at all, or had a specific topic dedicated to Civ 4 since 2011. That was not true, and I was actually surprised myself. I knew we had talked about Civ 4 more last year than this year, but until I started going through the topics, I didn't realize just how much we were talking about Civ 4 up to and including last year. And so after essentially, well, four full seasons, you know, almost five actually overall of just talking about or pretty closely talking about Civilization IV exclusively, it's kind of like, oh, we're not trying to say that we're done with Civ IV. We would never say that. So again, if there's something that you think that we've missed, you know, I set the topics. I do look through Civ IV forums on CFC and other major Civ sites and also on Reddit, gasp, to see if there is anything, but there really isn't a lot of conversation. And what conversation there is, we have talked about before. But at the same time, maybe there's something that, like a new approach to something. Yes, let us know. Point out specifically something that we have missed, and I'm certain it can find its way onto a future episode.
Yeah. And the game's old. So, where's all the Civ 3 fans yelling at?
Yeah, speaking, we could cover Civ even before Civ 4.
Yeah. What about Civ 3 fans? They're still playing it. Why aren't we relevant to Civ 3 fans? And Civ 2 and Civ 1.
We did cover a Civ 2 topic that one time. That guy who was playing the Eternal Game or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eternal Nuclear Winter.
That was awesome.
Yeah, they're probably Civilization 3 and Civilization 2 and original Civ fans that are like, really, Civ 4 players, you're complaining about coverage of your game on Polycast? Are you for real?
We want our coverage too!
I will say that this goes a lot of back to also what we as the regular co-hosts are playing in terms of Civ titles, and we also do play games other than Civ.
Ooh, you're evil.
Take a breath.
Oh, I sense a segue for right there.
No!
Because going back to the... No,
Max,
yes.
How can I be making a segue if I don't point out that it's a segue?
Yeah, so it's not actually a segue anymore.
It's okay. It's not a quasi-segue, but...
It's now a discussion point.
Yeah. We had a few more comments on episode 187. Dan thought he had the disagreement with us about the advertising things. No, I'm just poking fun at myself. He also said, keep it up and looking forward to episode 200. Well, that's next year, but that's not too far off, actually. That's what, middle of next year, maybe?
Yes. So Polycast in 2014. Now, in order for there to be an episode 200, Polycast would actually have to be renewed for 2014. Well, we are. Look at that.
Really?
Season 8 starting in January 2014. Yes.
Are sponsors signed up to that?
What sponsors?
Me, myself, and I, all three of them. We got 26 episodes and two specials is the intention. And all four regular co-hosts from Season 7 of Polycast are to remain as regular co-hosts next season.
And that's an order.
That's either good or bad, depending upon your perspective, but it is consistent. You can give us that much anyway. And yes, we are also keeping the live recording format that we began in Season 5. That was 2011.
Because it makes Dan's life a hell of a lot easier.
It does.
Sort of.
Helps in editing. Keeps us on topic. Helps me keep the release schedule consistent. So, yes. Since we have you on the panel here, Canis, wanted to thank you again for the Polycast era breakdown, as well as your epic poem that we read on episode 187.
I was pretty impressed with the music. You guys did a very good job reading it. I wasn't actually expecting you guys to read it, and I was emotionally moved by it. You guys did a great job.
Except for Mackie.
I don't know why it gave me the fit of giggles. I just, I don't know. Maybe that was just nerves. Oh my God, people are listening to me read a thing.
Yeah, and some of that ended up in the blooper reel, and some of it did not. I'm sure Mackie's grateful for that.
Oh, thank you.
But no, we wanted to do what you did for us justice. We wanted to show our appreciation for the time and effort that you put into it. And the music was actually the theme to Civilization 3 Conquest. There you go, Civ 3. We covered your... No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, just trying to get controversy now. Wow.
Yep, just going for it. More controversy equals more people talking.
The final episode of the year will be... some topics that we discussed earlier in the year but got cut due to time, which means we will start with episode 190 sometime in January.
Should I commit to writing the next canto?
That totally up to you.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because there was also a comment on our YouTube channels from Duskermaid, otherwise known as Dusky, saying that he really enjoyed it. And I said, you know, we enjoyed it as well. And we hope that in the coming months that there will be. So there are many coming months between now and the end of time. So, you know.
I'll see what I can do.
He may have another trip that he's bored on.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to cut yourself off from the internet for...
No, Dan.
For something, pull some wires out of the wall.
No.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Troll successful. I'd like to thank Phil for inspiring these trolls.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Shouldn't you thank me for playing into them?
Eh.
Oh. You've kind of thanked yourself, so no.
All right. Anything else? I need more coffee. No, when you have two cats staring at you, like, get out of bed, get out of bed, get out of bed.
Speaking of this, it's nap time. So, this was episode 188. I'm Makalua as usual, and of course with me was Dan.
I'm also staring at you to get out of bed.
And it's funny, since I do tend to record the podcast from the comfort of the Mackie bed. Imagine.
I am not in the comfort of the Mackie bed, so... Meh.
No, you're in the Imagine bed. You said you had cats staring at you. Get out of bed. Get out of bed.
That's right. That's why I said what I said, see?
And Dan's a cat, apparently.
I didn't say I'm also a cat. I just said I am also staring at you.
I've decided to use my logic.
Yes, therefore you are a cat, and therefore, anyway, me and team...
I'm always glad to inspire.
And our guest co-host this week, Canis Alvinus.
Did you know that if you replace the last two letters of Polycast with each other, you end up with Elizabeth and Catherine pulling each other's hair? S&T reversed Polycats.
Oh, Polycats.
So let's start with Venice, and then I'll come back with my general list.
Grow.
What are your secrets to growth? Growing.
Yes.
What's a chair? A chair. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for that. Clarifying now. We can... The opportunity cost for retweaking to incorporate this...
Yeah.
I'd rather have teams.
Did you say teams?
Teams actually work.
Oh, okay.
Wait, Anton wants to work on a team? What's this?
No! If anybody's interested in coming to check out that game, let me know. Including the people here on the call. There's people on the interwebs, too. But you can leave this out of the actual episode, because...
Oh, yeah, probably, yeah.
By that point, it'll already be done.
Don't worry, I'm just thinking, imagine talking again. Cut.
Cut this.
Zone out. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
I'm going to change it to actually Phil, your other topic. I know you just introduced this one, but let's have a double dose of Phil.
Oh, hey, yo! All right.
Poisoning? You need to seek medical attention? Let's risk it.
See, this is a segue.
Oh, an actual segue. Not saying there'll be a segue and then just starting the next topic. Very impressive.
An actual segue. Boring.
You mean... Apparently Phil's bored with the conversation.
Yeah, I see that you're next, man. What do you want from me? I can introduce your topic if you want.
Record date November 30th, 2013. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.